Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. You're about to watch the next episode of This Week in Law. This week, David Green joins us. He is the Civil Liberties Director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We're going to look at quote-unquote social media gag orders placed on various government agencies and the reaction to those, the formation of alt-government agency accounts. We'll look at the First Amendment ramifications of all of that and much more. We'll also look at the new FCC under its new chairman, Ajit Pai, and discuss and ponder the fate of net neutrality. We'll look at the fate and ponder the same of encryption and backdoors as well under the new Justice Department. And we'll bid a fond farewell to Axanar. This and much more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for TWIT's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make TWIT even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is TWIL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 374, recorded January 27th, 2017. Nobody expects the National Park Service. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, high-quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twill. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law here on January 27th, 2017. One full week after the inauguration of President Donald J. Trump, we have some tech policy issues that have come up during that week that will be interesting to go over today. Emery, great to see you.
Hey, Denise, great to see you as well. David, it's a pleasure to meet you digitally and chat. Thanks for tuning in.
Happy to be here.
Emery is one of my two co-hosts here at This Week in Law. He's a 3L that means third year law student, by the way, at California Western School of Law in San Diego. Mike Keyes is taking a pass on this week, has some busy work stuff going on, also has much busy work stuff going on, and we're thrilled to welcome to join us this week, in particular, is David Green, Senior Staff Attorney and Civil Liberties Director at the EFF. Great to see you again, David.
Happy to be back.
A little bit more background on David. He's the founding member of the Internet Free Expression Alliance, or a founding member. He serves on the Freedom of Information Committee for the Northern California Society of Professional Journalists. He also serves on the steering committee of the Free Expression Network and the governing committee of the ABA Forum on Communications Law. And in all his spare time, when he's also not litigating free speech and other internet rights cases for the EFF, he's teaching at the University of San Francisco School of Law, where he teaches First Amendment and media law, and also teaches at the journalism school there. As I mentioned, David's worked on many First Amendment cases over the year, including one that we've discussed on the show before and may be familiar to our listeners and viewers in particular, the Bunner versus DVD CCA case. So, David, we're thrilled you've been able to make the time, particularly because I expect that your docket is getting busy these days.
It's a very busy time.
Yeah. So. We want to go right into some of the developments of this week and in the area of First Amendment and the internet. And in particular, one saga that continues to play out that sounds like it could have been lifted right from one of those Joe Biden, Barack Obama memes that were going around. The The saga of which I speak has to do with the National Park Service and various other government agencies and their Twitter accounts. And the reason I say it harkens back to the Biden-Obama memes is I can just see one of those crafted that goes along the lines of nobody expects the National Park Service being said by Joe Biden and Joe Biden and Barack Obama rejoining Joe because the National Park Service sort of kicked things off a week ago, or maybe it was a week ago tomorrow, that account posted the now sort of infamous photo comparison of inauguration attendance on the one hand from a Barack Obama inauguration and inauguration attendance from the inauguration a week ago today. The pictorial evidence of which seemed to suggest a far smaller attendance at last week's inauguration than some others in the past. And the strange thing about this is the fact that it does not seem that the current administration anticipated or gave much thought to the fact that various government agencies have their own Twitter accounts and those Twitter accounts are accessible by various government employees who may have opinions that they want to express via Twitter or facts that they want to express via Twitter that might not be completely on message with the new administration. And we have been seeing that unfold over the last week with various tweets by various official government accounts, including the one I just mentioned, another one, for example, from the Badlands National Park on various climate change data. And here's one from Death Valley National Park as well, posting a picture of an individual who had been interned during World War II in a Japanese internment camp. So some of the messaging coming out of these official accounts has not exactly been what the current administration would vet and approve of had they the opportunity to do that. And then there has been this discussion of a quote-unquote gag order, which the White House has denied and said, no, we have not made any official statements or restrictions on government employees, and we'll get into that in a moment and what's going on there. But just to sort of complete setting the stage here, in the wake of some perhaps agency imposed restrictions on these accounts, a slew of unofficial alternative accounts have sprung up that, as we sit here today, we really don't know. We can't say with any masterful certainty that they are being authored by people who are current or former employees of these agencies, but that is what they purport to be. Some folks have done journalism digging deeper on that, trying to see if they can answer questions that only folks in those positions would be able to answer. But as we sit here right now, it's difficult to say whether those accounts are legitimate or maybe something more along the lines of the sarcastic Rover or fake Steve Jobs, something that is cleverly doing commentary, but perhaps not what it purports to be. So this is the situation in which we find ourselves with these social media accounts of various government agencies. And I suspect, David, that you've been finding this situation as it unfolds quite interesting.
Yes, it is quite interesting. I mean, I think it's interesting. I was just preparing yesterday, and I'm teaching a First Amendment class this semester, and I was preparing to teach the government speech doctrine and going over, restrictions on employee speech. And it was, I was being handed a law school hypothetical by the real world. So it has been very interesting. I think, we're a little bit handicapped here because we don't know exactly what happened. And we are actually dealing in hypotheticals. Sometimes we hear there's not an official gag order, there's There's just sort of an unofficial gag order. Sometimes we hear this is no different than what happens during any other transition where agencies are told to not issue policy pronouncements until the new administration is in place. And that's not typically a controversial thing. But I think the alternative, and then you had all these alternative, Twitter feeds going up, and some of them were using logos, which is potentially violating federal statute. Mm-hmm. So there was a ton of interesting issues, and in some ways the alternative Twitter feeds were a great example of civil disobedience that the internet enables.
Right.
Could you unpack some of the government speech issues that you were preparing for your class tomorrow? I think some of our listeners would like a little background, I guess, on why, for example, using logos might be problematic for them.
Yeah, well, the logos is a little bit of a different issue because there's a federal statute that governs the use of logos. So it's not even really operating out of we're not even looking at normal trademark considerations or something like that, where you would look at whether mm-hmm. or not people are actually confused by it or things like that. And that statute has generally been upheld that. Just using the logo. Well, I shouldn't say that. It just hasn't actually been tested that much. It would seem like to be like an unnecessary risk for someone who is otherwise clearly using having an alternative feed, or the name of the feed would be Alt, Park Service or whatever. It's an unnecessary risk for them to take. And I think most of them now have actually stopped using the official logos. So, I'm sorry.
Sorry, I was just going to throw this out there as a question to you. In my sort of research into this, obviously it seems like it runs near issues related to whistleblowing, but also perhaps implicates the Hatch Act. Do you want to unpack any of that or elaborate on? Obviously, there's a lot of these Twitter accounts that are one of the things that people are saying is that, these alt Twitter accounts should verify themselves somehow, either with third parties or with, some sort of trusted third party like the ACLU or the EFF or someone, so that we don't know that so that we have some sort of assurance that these are actually people from within the organizations. And I know that because some of these accounts are using the official logos of the organizations, there's particular concern that they would be running afoul of the Hatch Act. Do you want to elaborate into any of that or provide a little more expertise than I can provide?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on the Hatch Act. In fact, I'm really far from an expert on the Hatch Act. But I as a lawyer, I would advise them just don't use the logo. I mean, you're not trying to pretend that you're the official feed. And I think most of them have stopped doing that now. And whether that's a use of government resources for an improper private purpose, that's an interesting question that hopefully we won't have to answer. I do think, though, that an argument that I was hearing, which is sort of related to the Hatch Act issue, is whether it's proper for the government employees to use the knowledge they've gained as being public employees, to use that for private purposes, for their own rogue Twitter feeds. And I think mm-hmm. the First Amendment law there is pretty clear that that is proper, that that is protected.
Right.
And that was the last time the Supreme Court sort of jumped into the government employee speech doctrine. That's what it said. It distinguished speaking you do as a government employee because it's your job to speak in that way from speaking that you do that's not necessarily part of your job duties, but you're speaking because you have the knowledge as a governmental employee, and it found that the latter was protected, is protected speech. It is not, the restrictions would have to be subject to, to strict scrutiny as opposed to the very permissive standard for government employee speech.
Is there any differentiation to be made here, David, between the accounts that may be under a quote-unquote gag order here, the official accounts, the ones that actually belong to National Park Services and the EPA. Is there any argument to be made by or on behalf of those government employees from a First Amendment standpoint that they should be allowed to have a little bit more latitude on the official government Twitter accounts, or as Emory alluded to a moment ago, is really the more appropriate law that we should be looking at there, perhaps whistleblower law.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the problem with whistleblower law is that whistleblower law is its chief protections are to disclosure of unlawful conduct. And and what we have here is really just what they're saying is we're actually putting out truthful information that we think this that is might be counter to the new administration's policy. So I don't know that, you know, whistleblower law would protect the specific things I've seen. They it doesn't seem like the purpose of these is to disclose unlawful conduct, and that's the chief protection there. In terms of whether or not the government could gag them from tweeting, if tweeting was part of their jobs, the answer there is probably yes, is that they can. That would seem to be the more typical type of employee speech, government employee speech restriction, where there you're actually speaking for the government, you're speaking as a government employee, your speech bears the government imprimatur. These are all, you know, all the types of things we use to talk about why government can control the message. It's its message. It's the government's message. And when people are speaking on behalf of the government can tell them what they can and cannot say. And so I think if it's where it becomes – so if it's someone's job to tweet for the government through the official account, then that's – I think the government has the ability – it would seem would have the ability to restrict that.
And what about repercussions for individuals that were part of these organizations that may be tweeting out on their personal accounts in, I guess, not under the accounts that are officially the, you know, departments or the organization's, you know, official accounts, but their personal accounts, but tweeting specifically about this. That is totally First Amendment protected, right? There would be no risk to them for sort of tweeting out as a, like you said, as, you know, someone as a citizen, but because of the knowledge that they have because of their job.
Yeah, I mean, then you're if they're tweeting out not as part of their job, but use the knowledge they have as their job, then we're outside the government employee is sort of the government speech doctrine into the area where they're a private speaker and they have more protection. That's not to say they have absolute First Amendment protection. They can do whatever they want and they can't be punished for it. Then there's, you know, what the Supreme Court has said is in those situations, the government can, you know, can balance sort of the speech rights against the government's interests, you know, in its own message. And that balance is weighted towards free speech interests. You know, I, as a lawyer, would also argue that that actually should be subject to strict scrutiny as well. The Supreme Court hasn't really had the occasion to, you know, to do that. So, but I also think what you're mainly going to see is that these issues are largely going to be determined by government employee labor contracts. Before governmental employees can be punished, there's actually their union members, that the collective bargaining agreements and the union rules are probably going to set out the procedures for how that could happen. Are going to be the first level of protections before we even get to the First Amendment issues.
Right. And of course, there are national security issues to take into account as well here, not so much with tweeting out climate data, for example, but at least one of these accounts strikes me as very problematic from that standpoint, if it is legitimate. And that is the Rogue POTUS staff account, which is tweeting out things from within the White House. And again, I'm not saying that anything, if this is real, I'm not seeing anything here that looks like they're tweeting in violation of various security clearances. But again, just having, maybe I'm wrong about that. I mean, simply gossiping about, you know, the impression of the leader of the United States among his staff members, maybe that does violate national security requirements. But in any event, I can certainly see that this particular account and perhaps others might have repercussions, you know, where we're talking about the balancing between the free speech rights of the staffers, if that's who we're talking about here, in their private time and not in their professional capacity, and of course the national security and other government concerns.
Well, I'm hoping that if there is a national security argument, it's only going to come up because someone has actually revealed, you know, highly classified information, and not the First Amendment would certainly defeat an argument that there's a national security implication because the government is embarrassed or because, you know, that was Pentagon Papers, frankly. Uh-huh. Right? It wasn't revealing future strategy. It was just revealing really past bad policy decisions. So, I think anybody who would be, you know, any governmental employee who's considering disclosing national security information, confidential classified information, I might want to find a really highly secure way of doing that. It's probably not through a Twitter account. Go through a secure drop with a trusted journalist instead, because then, you know, certainly there's all, you're raising the specter of, you know, an espionage act action. If the government chooses to seize this as a crime.
Right. We have a link in the rundown, and if folks want to read everything we have in the rundown, I encourage you to do so. There's some very interesting reading in there. You can do so at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We are on episode 374 this week. And there's a piece at Motherboard by Jason Kobler, who suggests, as Emery alluded to earlier, that perhaps some of these accounts could be verified, and he's not talking about the blue Twitter check verification, but by going to a third party such as the EFF and vetting that the individuals involved are actually who they claim to be. What do you think about the EFF possibly playing that role? David?
Well, no one has asked us to do that. And we haven't discussed whether we would do it. I personally would be uncomfortable playing that role. I mean, as an organization, we're not ones where we don't take the role of trying to decide which of the speakers who want to speak are the best ones or things like that. I mean, we see the internet as a place for the open exchange of ideas, and everybody has the right to exchange ideas. And I don't think we'd want to see ourselves in a position as trying to, you know, certify some speakers as being better than others. And I don't even know that we would have the capacity, you know, how we would tell that, you know, how someone would be able to prove to us with certainty that they were somebody. I mean, you know, like any of these issues that comes up on the internet, and, you know, we've done this a lot since November, you know, talking about, you know, how do we know what's trust information? We all need to be media literate, right? We all need to scrutinize our sources and look for things and understand that until you're sure of who the source is, that you have to view something with a certain amount of skepticism and you keep an open mind about things. And that's you know what we've always been saying about finding material about content on the internet. Mm-hmm. So if someone wants to go out and verify people, that might be a useful service. I don't think that's something we would do.
Got it. You mentioned this whole scenario, giving you hypotheticals for your class. Oren Kerr of the Volokh Conspiracy, who's also a professor, tweeted out, I think it was last night, that the hypothetical he was taking from this had to do with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which would be implicated by some of the statements that Sean Spicer made in saying we did not impose gag orders. There are people within these organizations violating the policies of those organizations, and those organizations are dealing with those policy violations. I think that part of the problems identified there are that there are employees or ex-employees with access to the Twitter accounts because they know the logins, who may or may not still be authorized to tweet from those accounts, who are logging in and doing so. That seemed to be the implication. And I think that's where Oren Kerr was going with his Computer Fraud and Abuse Act suggestion that, you know, unauthorized access to the and use of the Twitter accounts may be problematic for those individuals. Any thoughts there, David?
Well, I agree that it raises issues under the CFAA. It's been our position at EFF that if you have a password that the CFAA isn't designed to sort of capture people have passwords using those passwords who have access to you, and so we've argued it's not meant to capture password sharing and things like that. What the Ninth Circuit, which has addressed this, has said is that that those things are bad, even if someone has a password, if there's been some type of express revocation of access, then that makes a CFAA violation. I don't necessarily agree with that, but that's what the Ninth Circuit seems to have settled right now. So I think under that, you would actually have to really look for whether or not these ex-employees, if that's what happened, whether their rights to access the account were actually expressly revoked. To me, it would not be sufficient if there was an implied revocation. I think in order to be liable under federal criminal statute, there's going to be some type of express revocation. And I have no idea if that happens as a matter of course when people leave an agency or not. But that's what I would really look for in order for there to be a CFAA violation. But I would agree with Oren, this makes a good law school hypothetical because this issue hasn't really been addressed by the courts. And as we know, the language of the CFAA is has been subject to, at least what we at EFF consider to be, very over-inclusive interpretations that we think go beyond, its intent as a statute against, actually hacking into systems.
Right. So there's good crossover this week between this story and several others that have come out between our show and Security Now. And I think this is one that Steve Gibson hopefully will get the chance to look at, what sort of security practices or not do government agencies take when people leave vis-a-vis specifically to denying or changing their ability to access.
I'm sure he'll be talking about Sean Spicer's tweets this week.
Yes, that were speculated to involve possible passwords. And then there were, what was the other thing, Emery? Something about the Twitter accounts lacking two-factor authentication being tied to Gmail accounts.
Yeah, Sean Spicer tweeted out. I mean, if we are going to touch on that, there is something that's a little interesting. Sean Spicer twice this week appeared to have accidentally tweeted out an 8 or 9 character password. By accident, which is clearly a snafu. But the one positive silver lining is that, well, it looks like he's definitely using a password manager, which is honestly more than I had expected or, have any reason to expect from most of our politicians. But yeah, also, and not only did he tweet out his passwords twice, but both Sean Spicer and Donald Trump's official government Twitter handles at POTUS and at press secretary, whatever the official press secretary handle is, are linked to Gmail accounts. Press sec are linked to Gmail accounts, not .gov accounts, without two-factor authentication. So just really,
I think they
really
changed
dumb.
That though. I mean, I think they probably actually did respond to having that flagged, and the follow-up I saw was that they were then linked to White House accounts. Who knows about two-factor authentication?
You would just think that, given how big of a deal using non-official email accounts for any governmental purpose played in the election, you'd think that that would have been on their radar screen a little earlier than they wouldn't have had to be called out on it publicly. And I think it's true. I think what we were all saying was, if you're really concerned about ex-employees who have the password, using these agency Twitter accounts, and you don't want to have to change the password every time somebody leaves, well, it's pretty easy to set up two-factor authentication on Twitter, and that's and change who gets the code. That's something they certainly could do. So, and should do, as the way we all should do it. So,
yes,
yeah, it's really really easy. Everyone go do it. But I got one more quick question, I guess, on the Twitter handle or the alt Twitter handles question. So I know that the Whistleblower Protection Act usually deals with reporting illegal activity, but when we see things like the head of the EPA doesn't believe in global warming or climate change, and is there an avenue for these organizations that are correctly limited in what they can tweet by policy, tweeting out things anyways, because they believe that it indicates gross mismanagement of the agency or abuse of authority. These other elements that the Whistleblower Protection Act is supposed to protect that aren't strictly a legal activity.
Yeah, no, that's a good thought. I mean, I think if you could say that it was, you know, at some point there's a line between policy differences and sort of gross mismanagement.
Right.
And the other thing is we all, as lawyers, we, you know, and as someone who we value whistleblowers, and we define whistleblowers much more broadly than federal whistleblower protections do. So I'd consider someone a whistleblower if they just disclosed it, any time they disclose information that the public should know, that's important for the public to know. The federal protections, they would have to prove that it was some type of gross mismanagement, the other language in the Whistleblower Act. And it's an interesting question whether disclosure of a policy difference reaches that level. I mean, as a lawyer, I would defend that. If that was the situation, is giving someone advice, that, you know, I think it's a fairly risky thing to operate that way. Mm-hmm. So, I think we're all better off for them doing this. I think this is, people are putting their jobs on the line. And I think that's actually what we want people to do if they really sharply disagree with the policy direction that the agency is going.
Yeah.
One thing to add on that point is Congressman Elijah Cummings of Maryland, who is the ranking member of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, and Frank Polone Jr. of New Jersey, ranking member of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, sent a letter to White House Counsel Donald McGahn, asking for that we have a White House counsel. I was not aware of that until reading this right now. Asking for immediate action to address the administration's gag orders on federal employees that prevent them from communicating with Congress. We urge you to immediately rescind all policies on employee communications that do not comply with the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act and other federal statutes, they wrote. I'm sure that Donald McGahn would argue there are no such policies in place. But it's interesting that Congress is asking them to pay attention to that. One other thing I just wanted to float by you, David. Again, there's no vetting of this. We have no idea if it's legitimate or not. But it's something that caught my eye as people were discussing this and throwing links around about it. A letter purporting to be from an EPA staffer. This was posted by Kelly Hayes to Twitter, saying, "So I work at the EPA, and yeah, it's as bad as you're hearing. The entire agency is under lockdown. The website, Facebook, Twitter, you name it, is static and can't be updated. All reports, findings, permits, and studies are frozen and are not to be released. No presentations or meetings with outside groups are to be scheduled. Any press contacting us are to be directed to the press office, which is also silenced and will give no response. All grants and contracts are frozen, from the contractors working on Superfund sites to grad school students working on their thesis. We're still doing our work, writing reports, doing cancer modeling for pesticides, hoping that this is temporary and we will be able to serve the public soon. But many of us are worried about an ideologically fueled purging. And if you use any federal data, I advise you to gather what you can now. We've been told the website is being reworked to reflect the new administration's policy." Is any of that, again, we already discussed that as any employer can, the government can put restrictions on its employees as to how they may communicate with the press and the public. Does any of this strike you as legally problematic, if it is legitimate and true, from a First Amendment standpoint, David?
No, it doesn't. Again, up until the point where it would interfere with their rights under federal whistleblower protection. But, you know, if you're telling people if you're redefining what the scope of their jobs are, that's not going to raise First Amendment protections. And again, I've heard things that, well, this is very typical for transitions. There isn't that unusual. And the only thing that's unusual here is that there might be a sharper policy difference between the old administration and new administration. And so that, you know, the order that looked the same the last transition, you know, is seem to have a greater effect here, and I have no idea whether that's true or not. what I think is a more interesting discussion, and this is not a First Amendment issue, is mm-hmm. whether this is the policy we want, whether we essentially want, you know, these agencies just to sort of stop what they're doing, you know, until the new administration figures that out, whether that's the right thing for us. And I think that's an issue that's worth discussing outside of any First Amendment issues, because I don't think the First Amendment is going to help as much in this situation. Again, it's going to help when they're speaking outside of their official capacities or you know, outside of their job duties. But it's not going to help so much just in what they do pursuant to their job duties.
So I think you just answered my next question, which has to do with the report that came out late yesterday from the Washington Post about a phone call a week ago Saturday. Again, confidential sources have told the Post where an individual acting National Park Service Director Michael T. Reynolds purportedly received a personal phone call from Donald Trump asking for more photographs, things that might, you know, be a different sort of impact than the ones that were tweeted that caused all the controversy. And I just wondered, you know, what you thought about any First Amendment ramifications of an administration official, namely the president, reaching out to an agency official in this kind of way, trying to change the dialogue, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that the First Amendment, again, is going to be the problem here, because this all seems to be internal government. And I think even with that article, there was some dispute as to whether he was being pressured to sort of make stuff up or mm-hmm. just pressured, like, you know, find photographs that support my position. And he said, well, I actually can't find any, mm-hmm. right? Like, these might help you or something like that. But again, it's someone just being told by their boss how to do their job, and that's typically not going to raise First Amendment issues. All that being said, I mean, I think we have what we've seen when you look at this incident with other incidents is how with the First Amendment issues that are raised with respect to what's being said about private media and their use of photographic evidence regarding the crowds, I think we have legitimate reason to be concerned about propaganda that we have an administration that's seeking to use, you know, to drive its policies by way of propaganda and is using its offices, you know, in a way as propaganda offices, which is not, you know, and I think that's the interesting thing we've seen with the Park Service this week. It's almost sort of battling, you could look at it as, you know, battling propaganda wars. And I think so to the extent that he's telling the First Amendment issue to me comes up is that if this is part of a larger propaganda campaign, that's going to have effects on how this administration both provides access to the media and what type of limitations they impose on coverage of the administration.
All right. Sorry, Emery, before I sort of transition away, did anyone have anything last thoughts, comments about the Twitter accounts we've been discussing and the activity we've been discussing?
Not on the Twitter accounts. What you just said, David, is sort of has my mind racing. I don't think I know much about the legal background behind propaganda. Is there any kind of legal limitation of how much government or what kind of propaganda the government can issue? Are there anything that's worth talking about there? That sounds really interesting.
I don't know of any legal restrictions on what the government can issue.
Right.
The government has a great amount of ability to control its own speech. The government can exercise viewpoint discrimination regarding its own speech, but it can't really do other, in other situations, under the First Amendment. What I think it's concerned is that if there is a propaganda campaign, that doesn't stop at the government's message, right?
Right. What,
historically, and I'm not a historian, I'm not a sociologist, so maybe I'm not the best person to be an expert on propaganda.
Opine away.
Typically, what, with that said, that caveat, you know, typically what you see is it doesn't stop at the government's message. It's also an effort to control the private messages, and to you know, to diminish and demean the contrary private messages, and to find private speakers who are willing to walk in step with you uncritically. And that's where you're going to get First Amendment issues, where if we're getting now access preference being provided to the lockstep media, and there being disincentives and discouragements and burdens and hindrances placed on media that want to cover the president, the administration critically. Those things would seem to be consistent with an administration that has an issue, has an interest and a policy in propaganda.
Do you see any signs of that based on anything you've seen this week, the press conference shakeups, you know, different order of people being called on, different people being allowed in the press corps, that kind of thing?
Well, I'm trying not to be alarmist about this, but it's sort of hard not to be alarmist about the press relations between between this administration and the White House media. So I think we've seen the first few press conferences certainly the press conference where the situation with CNN and him saying you're fake news calling on sort of non-mainstream but lockstep news organizations first in the press conference, in press briefings, the whole idea of sort of alternate facts, that there might be this alternate fact universe that the government's going to put out there, and everybody else who doesn't follow with that, who has evidence, well, they're just wrong. I mean, those are all things that seem to be part of a larger philosophy of disseminating the government's message and wanting the people to consume it uncritically.
I'm just going to toss this out there. I am in no way a fan of alternative facts or Kellyanne Conway's statement along those lines, but I just, my personal speculation on that is I suspect she misspoke badly, and that what she meant
you're
to say,
kind.
Yeah, what I suspect what she meant to say was alternative evidence. And if she had said that, we would not, the sort of panic that ensued afterwards and the sellout of 1984 from Amazon's virtual shelves, et cetera, none of that would have happened. So
well, that's very kind. I mean, she hasn't come out and said that she meant to say an alternative version or something like that. And again, it's true. I don't think it serves us well to be those of us who care about a free press and who think the press has an important role of criticizing administration. Even if you personally love the administration, right? The press plays an important role in criticizing and scrutinizing and being a watchdog over. And so I think if we care about that, we do get concerned about people who respond to press presenting what seems to be objective evidence and saying, well, we just don't think that's. We're just not going to accept it because we have this other vision. So I think that's something we have to be vigilant for and have to keep watching and push back against it whenever it happens.
Right. I was about to, a moment ago, put our first MCLE passphrase into this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases in case you are a lawyer or other professional who has to make a continuing education requirement in your field, and you are more than welcome to use our show to do that. We have some information for you if you're a lawyer to help you with that at wiki.twit.tv/This Week in Law. Find our show page there, and there's a whole chart of jurisdictions in the United States that will give you a hand with that. We put these phrases in, we put a couple in each show in case you have to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened and didn't just write down episode 374 on a list somewhere and turn it into your oversight board. So our first phrase is resistance by Twitter. We'll put another phrase in later on in the show. And Let's see. I felt like I had a final thought about that. Oh, I guess just as long as we're on the question of press conferences and access, and we have David with us who pays close attention to these issues. What was your reaction to the announcement that there will be remote journalists now attending press conferences via Skype?
Well, I think all access is good access. I mean, I think to the extent that any administration can maximize the number of people who get to be involved in its process, that's great. You know, it seems that, you know, if this situation, my concern in this situation would be if they are being selective in now who they provide Skype access to in a way to sort of build a lockstep media, you know, which would further propaganda. But to the extent that the White House wants to open up the press room via Skype to media on, you know, on a viewpoint neutral way, I think that would be great. Let's see if that's what happens. I don't think we should be limited by our press coverage of the White House based on how many people can fit in the room. We certainly encourage local governments, right, you know, to open up their meetings, you know, via the internet to increase public participation. And I think the White House can do that soon. What we have to scrutinize is now who's allowed access under these new rules, and if it seems to be that access is handed out in a viewpoint discriminatory way.
Yeah, that seems like a good thing to keep an eye on. And you know, my initial reaction was there should be lots of people. You know, having a virtual press conference seems like it's a great way to go. Although I was finding that in watching the press conferences that unfolded this week, they're having a hard enough time miking their journalists who are there in person. So let's just hope they get all their audio issues ironed out so that everyone can hear what the questions and answers are. A couple of other good First Amendment things we can and should discuss this week that David and EFF have been working on. Are you involved in the TechDirt case at all, or is the post at Deep Links, the wonderful EFF blog, sort of a statement of solidarity?
Yeah, it was just a statement of solidarity. We're not involved in the case. You know, TechDirt has lawyers, has really good lawyers, which is great for them. But we did want to post a statement of solidarity because this issue is important to our membership, DFF's membership, for two different reasons. One, it's important because you know, freedom of speech online is important, and we disapprove of any time, you know, litigation is being used in order to try and quelch reporting. This, you know, this sort of seems to be a typical slap, you know, type of situation. The other reason this is important, what we started to hear from our members as well, was the whole idea that someone is going to claim to have invented email. You know, the substance of the dispute here was of interest as well, because we have lots of, you know, lots of people were saying, well, I was using email well before this date, like, you know, at least 10 years before, you know. And we also just wanted to come out with so we were getting a lot of requests to say, you know, to come out and support. And I think there was, within the tech community, there was a sort of upswell of saying that, you know, we like TechDirt as an outlet, and this particular issue that they reported on, and this particular plaintiff in the case, is someone who we want to show we as a community are not going to be bullied by. And so that's how we felt it was important. You know, we don't always just come out with sort of statements of solidarity, but we thought that this was a good situation in which to do it.
Right, and I haven't delved too deeply.
But you should scroll down and show the little banner we put in this post so that people could also show state. There you go. If people want to add the banner, they could, you know, also show solidarity with TechDirt. So
just to give a little background for folks who haven't stumbled onto this issue yet. There is a gentleman named Shiva Ayadurai, probably butchering the name, who claims apparently to have invented email, and TechDirt has covered this over the years and used some fairly inflammatory language, accused him of perpetuating a fake story. I think have called him a liar at one point or another. Now they're being sued to the tune of $15 million in a libel lawsuit in Massachusetts against Tech Dirt's parent company, the author and founder, Mike Masnick, Lee Beeden, who I suspect is another writer there. And sort of sensationally, the counsel for the plaintiff here is Charles Harder, who is the attorney who represented Hulk Hogan, who represents Melania Trump, and who once upon a time was an associate of mine in a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away when we worked at a small law firm in Orange County together. He's been on the show before. Just sort of an interesting turn of events, and certainly the kind of lawsuit that Charles and his firm are known for pursuing. Any thoughts about this, Emery?
I mean, Mike Masnick and Tech Dirt publish some of the best, most entertaining, most hard-hitting tech law policy pieces on the web right now. It wouldn't be the first time, nor do I think it'll be the last time that, you know, lawsuits are brought with the express purpose of trying to shut down an organization or a news organization. I think that it's really disheartening. But it's great to see the EFF stand with Tech Dirt. I think that Tech Dirt has a stronger case than Gawker did when Charles Harder was coming against them. But, you know, it's still going to be a very expensive battle if they choose to fight it. And the damage could be, you know, just like we have a link in the show notes to the work that the EFF has done with the Kazakhstan's attack against Respublik. You know, they could be on the right side of the law, but they can still get inundated. They can get destroyed essentially by the legal fees. So definitely solidarity with Mike. And I wish them the best of luck. The idea also that, you know, this guy invented email, I think is patently false. And I think it's a good example of when, you know, judges and juries don't understand the technology that you get bad case law and bad precedent.
Right.
So hopefully, you know, with this defamation suit, you know, it's going to come down to showing that they didn't act with malice and that they didn't know that this was false. And so it's going to be, you know, the chance for other scientists, other engineers, other people that have firsthand knowledge, because this really isn't ancient history, guys, that, you know, Shiva is incorrect in his assertion that will hopefully, you know, bring the truth to light. It's definitely going to be worth following.
And actually, you know, this might be the rare defamation lawsuit if it goes forward, you know, if it keeps on going, where truth is actually going to be at issue. I mean, in many lawsuits, many defamation lawsuits are filed after reporting there's been revealed to be there was a mistake in the reporting. And then you're fighting over whether the mistake was there was sufficient culpability in the mistake. And that's whether, you know, we start thinking about whether or not we're under an actual malice standard, under a negligence standard. But in this case, I think the dispute is going to be whether or not what Tech Dirt and many, many others have written is true. And that's, you know, that's something that actually can be very difficult to resolve early in litigation unless there's an overwhelming amount of evidence to support it. And so that'd be interesting that you could actually, you know, really tee up a court looking at this question of did this guy invent email. I don't know that that's what he wants out of the lawsuit, but that actually might be where it's heading.
Hey, question you might be uniquely knowledgeable to answer, David, about this kind of lawsuit. Unlike in the Gawker case, I suspect there are no deep pockets on the defense side, but there could be insurance. Do you have a good take on when you're hit with a libel claim, if you have just standard business insurance? Or I know we've had folks on the show before who've talked about riders for blogging and writing online, or, you know, if you're at a more conventional or mainstream journalistic outlet, I'm sure there are insurance policies that would come into play. Are libel cases tending to be exempted from those policies, or how does that generally work?
Well, you know, let me first say that I'm not giving anybody legal advice about what their insurance policy says. You know, I think if you are creating and disseminating media, you know, as a profession, then you it's a really good idea to have a media liability rider on your insurance policy. And those things exist, and they exist, and they're actually exist to scale now as well. You know, they used to only be scaled to sort of large scale publishers, but actually you can get them that are to scale to people who, you know, who publish on a smaller basis. But you know, otherwise, if you get sued for anything, the first thing you should do is look at your any insurance policy you have and see if it provides coverage. And a lot of times insurance companies will provide coverage for defamation lawsuits under various general liability provisions. So whenever I get calls from people that say, you know, I can't afford a lawyer, my first question is always, well, do you have insurance? Have you checked? Have you tendered this claim to your carrier? So, but I think, you know, in terms of planning, if you think you're someone who is going to attract the, you're actually going to be publicly commenting about things a lot and expose yourself to liability, then you should at least investigate the possibility of or then you should look to make, you know, to have, be more knowledgeable about what insurance you actually have and whether you need more.
Definitely. Glad we were able to get that out there, and people should definitely be thinking about that however they express themselves online. And certainly if they're involved in regularly reporting on things like this person says they created email and we disagree. Let's move on to talking about other sorts of reporting of things online. Here, the Internet Movie Database, IMDb.com. Who are they owned by now? Didn't they get acquired?
I think it's Amazon, right?
Is it Amazon?
I think they're Amazon.
Yes. In any event, you are working on something involving them, David, and a California Civil Code section that requires commercial online entertainment employment service providers to remove an actor's date of birth or age information from websites upon request. How are these two things coming into conflict?
Yeah, so in this case, we filed an amicus brief. We're not representing IMDb, but California passed a law which just took effect beginning of this year, that said that if you have a website that provides a service, employment service, whereby you connect people seeking employment in the entertainment industry with employers, then you cannot include age information, so date of birth or somebody's age, if that person tells you not to, essentially. And the thing that swept in, and so that alone might not have been a big deal, but the way the statute was written, it said that, and that applied to all of your, you couldn't do that on the internet at all, not just on the sites that provided this sort of employment service. So this ends up affecting IMDb, and I have no idea whether there's any other website this law could apply to besides IMDb, but because IMDb has this pro service, which entertainment industry professionals use as an employment service, so they have a pro service which we as most internet users never see. But because they had this pro service, they became an entity that was within the definition of the statute, and that was now going to require them to take age information off of regular IMDb listings. So we filed an amicus brief against this. Actually, it was very brief. It was like a 3-page brief. just to make the very simple point that the legislature cannot – at the same time identify age discrimination in Hollywood, in the movie industry, as a tremendously important interest, a matter of public interest that needs to be regulated, and then deny the public the information to participate in that debate. And what this law did was prevent IMDb and anyone else to whom it would apply to for providing truthful information, information that's a matter of public records that's almost always going to be found in governmental records, that you know, people's actors and dates of birth or their ages. If the public wants to know whether this really is a problem, then they need to actually know people's ages and what's happening. And so what was so striking here was that legislature both recognized how important an issue this was and then disabled the public from taking part in the debate on that issue at the same time.
So the public record in question then that this information would be available from are people's birth certificates?
Yeah, vital records. You know, I mean, I don't know the law in every state on this, but the ones I'm familiar with, you know, vital records are a birth certificate, birth and death, and matters. Those things are all, those are public records. Anybody can, you know, anybody can get, it's different whether you can get like a real certified copy, but everyone, you know, everyone can certainly see them and the information in those is public.
Would this be different if we were talking about, instead of age, someone's sexual orientation that might be recorded on a public document as far as like a marriage certificate?
It might be different in terms of policy, but the First Amendment protects, and this isn't even a controversial point, the First Amendment protects the ability of someone to publish information they obtained from public records, from government records. And the First Amendment protects even broader than that. I would say it provides near absolute protection just to transmit any truthful information that's a matter of public information that you've obtained legally. So our sympathies might shift, or maybe you couldn't find a policy reason why it was important to the public to have access to the information. But if it is information that's obtained from a public record, then anyone has the right to publish it.
Right. And getting back to, we mentioned Bunner versus DVD CCA at the top of the show. Do those principles come into play in this kind of analysis too, where if the genie's already out of the bottle, if the information's just out there,
It just adds another layer. I mean, in Bunner, there was trade secrets, so that was sort of a whole different thing. But just the idea that if the public interest in protecting something is because there's an interest in it being secret, but the information is actually not secret or is really readily available, then there's really no public interest that's going to be strong enough to justify a speech restriction.
Right. Are you old enough to remember that case, Emery?
No.
No? Don't remember? No. It was hysterical. It was one of these, you know, again, sort of Twitter protest kind of situations, although I don't know if Twitter even existed at the time. It was more of a website protest situation where the code necessarily to decrypt DVD copy encryption was widely disseminated and posted everywhere online.
I remember that in high school. Yeah, there was a t-shirt one of my friends had with it on it.
Right. Oh, people were wearing the t-shirts to the court hearings.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
The thing you don't want anyone to see, someone has it on a t-shirt, you know, right there. Yes. So.
Yes. All right. Where shall we go from here? We should probably take a break. It's just after noon o'clock here on the West Coast, which is a good time to be thinking about lunch. So I would love to get you thinking about not just lunch, but cooking for yourself. And cooking for your family and cooking delicious food with Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in this country. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone while supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with fresh, high-quality ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. You'll save time and money because shopping at the grocery store is 60% more expensive than Blue Apron. If you spend a lot eating out or at high-end grocery chains, you can now spend under $10 per person for healthy, home-cooked meals. Customize your recipes every week based on your dietary preferences and choose a delivery option that fits your needs. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them, and Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental United States. Blue Apron sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranches across the United States. Blue Apron not only supports a more sustainable food system, it supports happy and healthy families. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly three times more often. That is my personal favorite part about this service, is not only are you cooking delicious meals, but you're doing it together. You're passing along, even if you're not a great chef yourself and you don't have, you know, a whole lot of culinary training, you're passing along to the youngsters in your home. The fact that you don't have to always go out to a store or restaurant to pick up really wonderful and maybe not, you know, your most culturally first choice or first, let's just say, I'm trying to say you don't always have to make cheeseburgers and fried chicken, okay? You can make things like spicy shrimp and Korean rice cakes with cabbage and furikake, pork chops and garlic piccata with scallion rice and spinach, mushroom and chipotle pepper enchiladas with lime sour cream, hoisin chicken steam buns with broccoli and marinated carrots. And that's really, I mean, just sort of the adventuresome deliciousness, flavorful, interesting spice palette that's involved in these dishes are what make it really fun for our family. And I'm glad that I'm teaching my kid that you can cook at home and you can cook really interesting, fun things at home. I like too that if you're not a big chef, aside on their recipe cards, there are very simple step-by-step, photographically enhanced instructions of how to do things. And if you ever get into something really complicated, they'll tell you where to go online on their site to say, oh, well, if you've never julienned something before, you know, here's how you do it. So it's a sort of full service, how to get through a wonderful meal experience with Blue Apron. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twill. That's blueapron.com/twill. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for your support of This Week in Law. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. All right, so we're going to move on off
well,
the
first.
Can
we go let's ahead. Make a quick plug to the Twit survey. Listeners, watchers, chat, and friends, if you could please go to twit.tv/survey. We are doing our annually, I think it's only once a year, survey to gauge your interest, to figure out sort of what kind of programming you'd be into, how much you like this show, lots, I hope, and you know, what sort of advertising would be relevant to you. So if you could go to twit.tv/survey, it'll only take 2 minutes. You could finish it while you're listening to the show right now, and it would be super helpful, and we'd all appreciate it. So head over to twit.tv/survey now, please. Thank you.
Yes. And just to reinforce too, we are here on This Week in Law. We talk a lot about privacy issues and valuing people's privacy here on this show. And we value your privacy in connection with this survey. We don't identify you in any way when you take the survey. So we just want to hear from you. We want to get feedback and do a better job for you. So it's at twit.tv/survey. We appreciate the help. All right, let's move on to some issues relating legislation, regulation, and policy. Let's start with Jeff Sessions, whose confirmation as Attorney General of the United States has been delayed by a week. As I understand it, consideration of his confirmation has been pushed back. We thought there would be a vote perhaps as early as Tuesday of this week, but that has been postponed. And in the meantime, that gives us time to talk about the fact that not at the hearing itself, but in the questions related to the hearing. I guess these cabinet nominees are, in addition to testifying in the Senate, they're also given questions that they can respond to. One of the things that Jeff Sessions was asked is his feelings about strong cryptography and whether it is foundational to the future and national security and, you know, important to maintain. And the response that we got from Jeff Sessions is encryption serves many valuable and important purposes. It is also critical, however, that national security and criminal investigators be able to overcome encryption under lawful authority when necessary to the furtherance of national security and criminal investigations, causing everyone who has followed this issue on the technology side to start ripping their hair out and saying, no, you can't have it both ways. So I wanted to bring this up with David in particular, because not only, you know, is it an important tech policy issue, but certainly there are speech ramifications to the Department of Justice taking a we want to backdoor encryption stance as well. So what's your take, David?
He gets in line now with all the other law enforcement who want the magic pony, right? You know, who say, sure, encryption's strong. I mean, I do online banking, right? I want to have strong encryption. But we're the exception, right? It needs to be strong for everybody but us. So, you know, go design something that's, you know, we're the only ones can get into. And as we know, that's just not the way encryption works. This is another time where I've said, you know, go read the Keys Under Doormat article that was written, you know, that was coordinated by MIT, but, you know, has, you know, written by however many security, you know, leading security experts to explain what they really try and brainstorm. Would there be a way of you know, having strong encryption, what the key would be under the doormat for law enforcement, where with legal process they were able to obtain permission to break it, and the answer was no. So
right, and we have a link to that in our discussion points for people who want to delve into that more deeply. Please do go check it out.
Yeah, and they'll say it better than I ever could.
Yeah.
So, I do like to remind people that this is a restriction on speech. To the extent that you want to hinder or forbid or bar people from communicating in the language they want to communicate, and what encryption is choosing to communicate in a certain language with only the people who will understand that language, and so it is a First Amendment restriction. Any restriction on encryption, and this is something we at EFF have been saying for, you know, 20 years. You know, any restriction on encryption is a restriction on speech, and any, you know, surveillance of communications that you want to do, which is that your end goal of breaking encryption, is going to be a restriction on speech. On speech as well. So there are grave First Amendment concerns with if there's going to be a Department of Justice policy that would back crypto backdoors. Now, these are the same concerns we've had for a long time. I don't know that there's been a Department of Justice that's been crypto friendly in a way where they would say, okay, well, we understand that we don't get access to everything either. We heard the going dark rhetoric from the last administration. I expect we'll only hear it more strongly now.
Yeah.
Could you tell us more about Bernstein versus Department of Justice, which is something that the EFF worked on, 27 years ago now, or so?
Oh, was it that? I don't know if it was that.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. But I'm looking at a post that was on EFF at 25, but no, this didn't go back to its inception. It says this was in the early 90s. Tell us more about this. And yeah, maybe it was 27 years ago. tell us about this case and how code can be speech.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, you have to rack my brain a bit. You know, Bernstein was actually the very first case I worked on with EFF when I was at a different organization, but we used to, you know, collaborate with EFF all the time. And essentially, Bernstein was a challenge to export controls, whereby encryption was defined as ammunition that could not be exported from the U.S. And the lawsuit said that that was a speech restriction. You were telling people that they could not use encrypted messages with communicating. You're telling U.S. persons you could not use encryption when communicating with people in, you know, outside the country. That would be considered exporting the encryption technology. And if even to just develop the technology, you could not support that. And so one of the things in order to set that up as a speech challenge, as a First Amendment challenge, was to establish that communication, that encryption and communication by encryption is speech protected by the First Amendment. And the way it got framed in that case and in one other case as well that was going on in Ohio at the same time, which EFF was also involved in, was to say that, you know, computer code, you know, communicating by code is speech. And that it was really the first time the courts had to confront the issue of whether coding is speaking in the way we use the word speaking in the First Amendment. And the courts, both the court in Ohio and the California court here, and ultimately the Ninth Circuit, found that it was, that code is speech, that the First Amendment is implicated when there's a restriction on disseminating code or encoding itself. So, right. Now that's such a settled point, but that was a hard fought battle for many years to get to that point.
Is it such a settled point? I'm wondering, sort of two questions here, if there's been much law since then on this front, and how confident you were back when the Apple versus FBI tussle was going on, that argument would prevail in that case.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's I think that code is speech and is a settled law. I mean, mm-hmm. it doesn't end the question. It doesn't end the analysis, because the First Amendment doesn't, just because you can implicate the First Amendment doesn't mean it makes all governmental action illegal. It just mm-hmm. puts you into, you know, First Amendment analyses of First Amendment scrutiny and things like that. And that was our position in Apple versus FBI. We were just in an amicus brief there. We certainly weren't representing Apple. Mm-hmm. And there I actually thought, to me, it was actually a really clear example of compelled speech. That our position was that if they wanted to compel Apple both to write the code and then to certify that it was authentic so that it would actually be an acceptable upgrade, that they were actually compelling Apple to speak and actually adopt a belief system. You know, this is a good app. This is a legitimate app. That was a speech compulsion and would have to satisfy the First Amendment test for compelled speech. I think that was a good argument. You know, the case went away
right.
Before a court had a chance to consider it, and whether the court would have even taken it up or would have just looked. I think the government had a problem even, you know, outside of the First Amendment in that case, satisfying just the test for under the All Writs Act for for whether when you can require somebody to facilitate a governmental investigation. So I think the government had a problem there, even short of the First Amendment issues. But I think there was a legitimate and strong First Amendment argument against what the government wanted to do there.
Emery, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this a lot of times before. You know, it's anyone that says that we should put crypto, that we should backdoor our crypto, it's a bad idea on so many fronts. It's a bad idea on a civil liberties surveillance, you know, Big Brother front. It's a bad idea on a cybersecurity front. But I think that the real takeaway, that if we want to beat this idea back to what, in the way that it definitely needs to be beaten back, is that we need to drive home the fact that this is a really dumb idea as far as efficacy wise. There's just, you know, we're talking about policing knowledge. And we're talking about policing speech, exactly. You know, this is technology that is out in the open. The Pandora's box is open, or whatever analogy you want to use. It's you can't put it back in the bottle. And so, you know, backdooring crypto, requiring, you know, regulations that would backdoor crypto, first of all, would not be useful in stopping the underlying problem that they're complaining about. It would only, at the very most, be, you know, American products. So the day that there is a law in place that requires that, you know, And like, if you just try to like think about how would this process work, it's like, okay, so are they going to require everyone, are they going to require Microsoft and Apple to release versions of their operating system that is signed by, you know, that only runs software that is signed by government keys? Are they going to require everyone to upgrade their operating system on all their devices? Or what happens to all these legacy devices in the wild? And anyways, even if they do that, the day they do that, it's going to be an app made in Syria or anywhere else in the world that does exactly the same thing because it's open source and it's knowledge and it's not going to do anything. But yeah, it's, you know, it is the type of issue where cryptography and I think encryption and cybersecurity is just enough of a sort of sexy, mysterious technology that it requires just too much technical understanding, more technical understanding than I think our politicians are willing to put to actually grokking the issue. Because I think that once politicians actually do grok the issue or take the time to understand the underlying technology, then they usually say, oh, well, wait, this isn't possible. You know, so David Liu of California, for example, which is like, this is, you know,
He's a computer scientist too.
Well, yeah, so he would know. Yeah. Of course.
I almost feel and almost hope that what we're headed for is perhaps a disagreement or discussion between the justice part of the government and the consumer protection part of the government. And the reason I say that is because we're just a couple of weeks out from The Guardian breaking a story about WhatsApp and people then getting down and splitting hairs over whether WhatsApp was backdoored or just as Steve Gibson said on his show and in his very good explanation of everything that was going on here at episode 595 of Security Now, if you haven't caught it, just a big problem. Not necessarily a backdoor, but just a security issue that people should be aware of. And the reason I tie it into, you know, justice wanting one thing and maybe the more consumer protective aspects of our government wanting people to know, hey, you think you're using a secure application here, but really there's an issue with it where the security is not perfect end to end. And maybe there should be requirements that be disclosed, I guess, is what I'm getting at, more so than it is now, because I think the rank and file of people using WhatsApp would have no idea about the weeds and details that Steve Gibson goes into such great length in on the show I mentioned. What do you think about that, David? Could we get some relief from regulators who want communications platforms to be more secure, or if they're not, to disclose that?
I don't know. If there's a, my guess, and maybe I'm just being really pessimistic, is that if there's a conflict between law enforcement interest and a consumer protection interest, that the law enforcement interest is going to prevail on a policy level. And so I do think if you ever get the law enforcement talking to consumer protection, I think law enforcement is going to tell consumer protection, we just don't care about consumer protection in this situation. And that's basically what they've said before. Yeah, we understand this stuff is important. The separate question of whether there should be sort of more regulation regarding consumer protection, I don't know. It's hard to like support regulation with the uncertainty we face with this administration. I think a lot of us who work in this space, our inclination right now is to look for, even if our inclination might always be to look for solutions outside of the government, and maybe even more so now just because there's so much uncertainty regarding this administration's tech policy. At EFF, our position has always been that the industry needs to self-regulate, and we push companies to be transparent and informing their consumers so that consumers can make correct choices about these things. And that's always been our strategy.
All right. Anything else on encryption, you two, before we move on?
I think that it's going to be an issue we continue to talk about over the next 4 years. I saw an interesting article right now. I'm furiously Googling to try to pull it up, but discussing the fact that at the same time as, a lot of these people in the Trump administration are talking about the need to backdoor crypto, the use of privacy enabling messaging to apps like Signal or WhatsApp is on the rise. And the question of whether or not for our government officials, do we want to be encouraging them to be using apps like Signal that provide perfect end-to-end forward security? Because those conversations are no longer foiable afterwards. I think that sort of looping it back into the larger discussion, it comes down to, threat modeling and recognizing, where are your risks. And with the WhatsApp discussion, there was, yes, the risk that maybe you may be man in the middle without knowing it is there. But at the same time, when choosing to use WhatsApp over your default text messaging or to use WhatsApp over Signal, there are a whole host of other, factors that are in play in making that decision. The general view is uneducated, I guess, uninformed about how the technology works is going to continue to be a thorn in the sides of privacy advocates and cybersecurity experts for the next X years.
Yeah, David, what do you think about encryption and FOIA? Is there any argument to be made that there's tension there that needs to be resolved?
Well, I think in most cases there's resolvable tension. I think if we suggest Signal all the time to people, right? But the government actually has resources to develop a system.
Sure.
It's possible to both encrypt your messages and to preserve them in a way that it could be responsive. They could be responsive to FOIA requests, and with the president and the president's offices, then you actually have to worry about the Presidential Records Act as well, which actually affirmatively requires preservation. And I think that was the problem with those subject to the Presidential Records Act using Signals, because in order to preserve the information, they're essentially going to have to screenshot. All of every Signal communication, and then hopefully store them securely, right? So, I do think we have to do both, right? You have to find a way of communicating securely and institutionalizing that, as well as institutionalizing the preservation of records as you're required to do by law. I don't think that's impossible to do both.
The way I think it's impossible. At the same time, how difficult is it to get our politicians to use 2FA or to figure out?
I don't think it's technologically impossible. It might be hard for them to do. It might be difficult for them to convince them to do, the same way it seems to be difficult to convince people not to use Gmail for their, instead of their Senate.gov, emails. Even though on a security basis, Gmail is probably better in that situation.
Yeah.
But I think it's possible to design a system whereby, messages are still encrypted, but also at the same time are captured for purposes of FOIA and Presidential Record Act and other record retentions requirements, and then kept securely.
I'm wondering, David, if you have any thoughts on presidential record retention that relate to our president now having two Twitter accounts. Is there any argument that his original @RealDonaldTrump account has any lesser requirements on it than the official POTUS account does?
Well, there might be an argument. I think there's a stronger argument based on the president and his staff's statements about that, how he is using Twitter as part of his official duties, and that it's part of an affirmative strategy to communicate with the public through his Real Donald Trump Twitter account, that it's all now subject to FOIA, subject to the Presidential Records Act, certainly. So, I haven't checked Muck Rock lately, but I imagine there's actually lots of records requests going up about this as well. That's the choice. That's what he's choosing to do. But you can't I think there are harder cases out there where someone hasn't said, I'm using this in order to do my job duties, communicate with the American people. And then we'll fight about whether or not that's now subject to public records laws. But here I think it's actually an easier case.
What do you think is the role or obligations of a company like Twitter that's not an arm of the government that's being used here? Are they affirmatively required to comply with the acts that require these to be maintained in the event? And I'm sure this, we have countless examples of tweets that have been deleted already. Do you think that it's just, I'm sure Twitter is making sure that they're preserving things, but do you think they have to?
I'm sort of trying to run through my recollection of the Presidential Records Act. I don't think it imposes an obligation on anybody other than the Office of the President. So I don't think Twitter has an affirmative, the law imposes an obligation on any private actor. Again, if I'm missing some law that does that, I apologize. But I can't think of one that in any of the records preservations requirements that require a private actor to preserve records in that way.
Yeah, that would be my impression too. And it's also my impression that of course everything is being screenshotted by multiple sources as soon as it's tweeted. So there's a record. It's just a question of, you know, whether it's a verifiable record of what was out there or not. All right, we're going down something of a rabbit hole here, but I thought that was just something interesting. And again, something we're seeing unfold sort of in real time online in the early days of the administration here. Something else that is unfolding is speculated last week, we now affirmatively do have a new head of the FCC. It is Ajit Pai, if I'm saying his name correctly. And he is, from his statements in the past, no huge fan of, and of course his votes in the FCC as well as a commissioner there, no huge fan of the current open internet rules. We were talking last week about Tom Wheeler and his statements that he thought that the D.C. Circuit's repeated upholding of the FCC's open internet rules were a good sign and they were going to be hard to undo. But it does seem that the effort will be made to do that. And in fact, Ajit Pai, in a December 7th speech to the Free State Foundation, a free market think tank, said he was more confident than ever that the days are numbered for the net neutrality regulations. So net neutrality, of course, is just one thing to talk about with Ajit Pai, but let's start there. David, what are your thoughts and who do you think is right, Wheeler or Pai?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I mean, I think the only thing that might be the difference might be the speed at which the open internet order is voided. During the transition, there was a fair bit of brokering that was going on to be about when the administration would have a majority of supporters for its policies on the FCC, about, you know, when people would resign and when they'd be replaced and things like that. But it seems like with Pai's appointment that the Republicans will have a voting majority on the FCC, and that and the present the administration has said that it wants to see net neutrality go away, and I think it showed that by appointing Ajit Pai. I hope, for those of us who are fans of net neutrality, I hope it takes it's difficult to do administratively. But I think the only question might just be, a matter of time. You know, hopefully what that time buys people who are advocates for net neutrality is time to advocate and to rally the public. And maybe that will have some effect.
Of course, there are speech ramifications to net neutrality as well. And Ajit Pai has spoken about that, but not in the way that I'm used to hearing people discuss how speech comes in to net neutrality. My usual take on that is, in order for speech to be robust and thriving and not impeded by the government, there should not be governmentally sanctioned channels that allow certain speech to go forward and others not to. So I assume there are free speech arguments to be made in favor of keeping the open internet rules. But Ajit, and you can expand on that, David, in a moment. But Ajit Pai has said a couple of times that he considers net neutrality regulations to be a dangerous assault on the culture of the First Amendment. There's an article at the Washington Examiner that I haven't put in our discussion points yet, but I will after the show, where he's asked to unpack that. He makes that statement and he's asked to unpack it a little bit more. And he goes on to discuss college campus culture and how minority viewpoints can be shouted down, and he doesn't want to see that happen, but he doesn't really tie it back to net neutrality. So he thinks that ISPs, I believe, have free speech rights that are being impacted by net neutrality. So can you unpack that a bit for us, David?
Yeah, let me, I'll unpack it a little bit. And this is not a new argument. I mean, and net neutrality has always had First Amendment interests on both sides. There's always been First Amendment interests on both sides of this issue. And there were First Amendment interests on both sides of this issue when the same rules were being applied to the cable television industry as well. And the idea is that internet service providers have First Amendment rights to editorial discretion and First Amendment rights to decide what content they want to deliver and what they don't want to deliver. And that's, a fairly that in and of itself is a fairly well-established First Amendment principle. You know, what came up in these situations was that there was a countervailing First Amendment right, given the specific nature of the forum, to allow protection for consumers to receive what they wanted to receive and disseminate what they wanted to disseminate without having to go through without giving the ISPs the power of being a filter. Mm-hmm. I think as long as there's been a debate on net neutrality, there's been this debate about these competing First Amendment values. And I think it's a hard debate. I think it's a tough legal question. I think even those who are very strong supporters, or maybe not everyone, but I think a lot of people who are strong supporters of net neutrality is something they thought about very hard and considered before coming out on that side. So I don't dismiss that as a First Amendment argument. I think our position is that in this particular situation, it gotten to a point where the balance shifted. At EFF, we called for, we supported bringing the ISPs under the regulatory framework as long as there was also a great deal of forbearance of the regulations outside the Open Internet Directive. So, and that's in recognition of the competing First Amendment issues. So right. One of the things I was just thinking of, and I don't know the answer to this, I don't know if someone listening or watching can quickly do a web search. There's been a legal chat. There's a First Amendment legal challenge to net neutrality. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, I wasn't sure exactly where that was procedurally right now. But I don't know also, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, is whether it would be possible for the Justice Department to take a position in that litigation that would essentially be a shortcut around actually changing the rule at the FCC level.
Right.
So someone wants to look that up while we're talking.
I was frantically Googling, and what I'm getting, the first hit I get is from June of last year. The D.C. Circuit today upheld the FCC's net neutrality regulations and rejected Let's see. By rejecting the ISP's First Amendment claim, the court not only maintained the current state of First Amendment doctrine with respect to common carriers, but more importantly, held the line against corporate First Amendment expansionism. As many scholars have documented, Yochai Benkler, Jack Balkin, Robert Post, and others, corporations have sought to undermine publicly interested regulations as a violation of corporate First Amendment rights. The ISP's constitutional claim that the transmission of data constitutes their speech represented a new front in that corporate war on regulation. And fortunately for the public and their interests in free expression, the DC Circuit rejected it. So I think it was at least, I don't know if there's a separate challenge still pending.
That's like, I wasn't sure if that resolved the whole case or if there was any part of the litigation that was still going on. I mean, I think if you're going to make a significant change, it's much more important that it actually go through the regulatory process, which is what Commissioner Wheeler was saying. And that this is it's not easy to undo regulations. I think the administration is discovering this with the ACA now. I mean, it's these things have tentacles everywhere. And it's not, it's not as simple as just sometimes it's not easy just to get rid of the part you don't like without having to then fix a whole bunch of other things. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't know exactly how to frame this question, but we were mentioning just a moment ago, EFF's sort of hands-off regulation approach when we were talking about, should there be more consumer protection involvement in security touting communications software. Does the EFF have a similarly, or has it sort of wrestled with a similarly hands-off regulation approach to net neutrality?
Well, we certainly wrestled with it wrestled with it quite a bit. And I think that's just this wrestling mat to sort of laid out on our website before we ultimately came down in support of net neutrality. And then, although again, with the idea of there'd be a amount of forbearance from much of the regulatory scheme. It's certainly a wrestling process. I wasn't personally involved in that wrestling process just based on when I actually joined EFF. But it was, it was certainly, it's not a decision. We don't take any decision lightly. And that was certainly one that we did not take lightly. It was subject to a great deal of debate and consideration.
All right. Other things just to mention about Ajit Pai becoming the head of the FCC. For folks who don't know, part of his background is as general counsel for Verizon. For a bit there. We have a link to his Wikipedia page in our discussion points if you'd like to know more about his background. Also, what else? The set-top box issue. The GOP has been, apparently there's still an open action item at the FCC. I don't know how to classify this, but there's still the action that the FCC may take on imposing regulations on set-top boxes, and the GOP has asked Ajit Pai to take that off the table. It seems like that will happen because the various proposals that have been put forth, and there's good coverage of this if you want to read about all the back and forth at the FCC on this issue at Ars Technica. The back and forth has sort of left things at a stalemate, as far as I can tell from reading through that the FCC wanted to take some steps that would make it easier for third parties to supply set-top boxes for you not to have to rent them from your cable or satellite providers. And or maybe satellite doesn't fall with this in this. Of course, when you get into the telecommunication stuff, it all depends on what channel and how you're transmitting things. But in any event, for cable, there was a lot of back and forth, and it basically was left with they haven't done anything. The GOP doesn't want them to do anything. And this is from Ars Technica. Pai has said that the FCC should focus on eliminating traditional set-top boxes by encouraging cable providers to deploy more video applications that can replace the devices, but it hasn't supported requiring the cable companies to do so. In general, he's pledged to eliminate regulations for communications companies rather than add new ones. So it doesn't seem like there's going to be under the FCC run by Ajit Pai, we shouldn't look forward to any restrictions on set-top boxes from the FCC. Emery, anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, you know, where to start? We're losing Tom Wheeler, which is honestly a huge bummer. I think that it's undeniable. I think everyone agrees that Tom Wheeler really, as far as, you know, consumer privacy and consumer protections are concerned, vastly outperformed everyone's expectations. Ajit Pai has, on a consumer protection front, been a continual source of opposition to, I think, some pretty common sense or at least well-reasoned, well-argued consumer protections and consumer protective regulations that tried to be passed over the years. But he's also very clearly very intelligent and a great speaker and a great writer. And he's, you know, very good at making his argument. But at the same time, it's tough to, you know, as David said, it's tough to feel optimistic about the open internet order right now. I think that Ajit Pai has basically, from the beginning, as soon as it was passed, prophesied that whether it would come out, whether it would go down through a new law or Congress or a future administration, a future commission, that he expected the open internet order would be struck down. And I think it's very likely that that's going to take place. As far as how that happens, you know, ideally, it happens through another rulemaking, the standard rulemaking procedure, which would require a period for open comments. In the past, when we've seen times like that, it's, you know, resulted in huge upswells of support from the internet and, you know, internet community and internet industry. So maybe, you know, we have some support there. There is always the possibility that the Telecommunications Act is simply amended or rewritten or updated. And that could, by way of that, that could sort of end run around the rulemaking process. It's tough, though, to when Ajit Pai says that the open internet order and net neutrality regulations stymie innovation and hurt consumers, it's tough to sort of make that jive with the fact that he has opposed regulations that would, for example, open up the set-top box market to third-party manufacturers. You know, when you're trying to say that you want free market for one industry, for one aspect of that industry, but not for the other aspects of that same industry, it comes across as a little intellectually dishonest, I think. And, you know, as he also has supported the mergers of these major ISPs over the years. He's sort of pushed back against opposition to these mergers, which definitely does not, you know, ring true on a sort of free market. You know, the free market solves everything. Consumers are going to be able to get the best deal if we just keep everything hands off. So yeah, he's going to be a force of opposition for a lot of consumer protection agencies and organizations, rather nonprofits, over the next few years. So it's definitely something that we will be paying close attention to and will come up again as this issue continues to play out.
Well, I think this discussion gives us our second MCLE passphrase for the episode, and that's going to be fire up the weed whacker, because that's what Ajit Pai has said, as reported in the LA Times. His quote, we need to fire up the weed whacker and remove those rules that are holding back investment, innovation, and job creation, said in a speech last month, looking ahead to Republican control of the FCC. So fire up the weed whacker is our second passphrase for the show. And before we go ahead and wrap up the show with our usual closing type materials, we're going to head on over to Hollywood to say goodbye to an old friend. We learned last week, right after the show, just after we had discussed the outcome of one of the motions in limine in the Axanar case, that the Axanar case has settled. And it's not that I'm sad to see the case settle per se. I'm sure the parties, lots of cases settled. The vast majority of cases heading for trials settle. So it's no big surprise. But for us here at This Week in Law, it was sort of the equivalent of someone sending around, whenever we got to talk about the case, was sort of the equivalent of someone sending around that office email that lets you know that there's cake in the conference room. You're still at work, but you're about to have a really good time. And so we're really sad that our ability to chew over the issues in Axanar seems to be at a close, because the parties announced that they settled their case. The settlement is sealed from public record, but they issued a joint statement noting that they acknowledge that both films were not approved by Paramount or CBS, and that both works crossed boundaries acceptable to CBS and Paramount relating to copyright law. The settlement will also require Axanar to make substantial changes to Axanar to resolve the litigation. This includes changing the proposed feature-length film into two 15-minute short film episodes, which will be posted on YouTube without advertising, from which Axanar could earn revenue. The 20-minute prelude to Axanar will be allowed to stay on YouTube. So this case has been resolved. Farewell. Live long and prosper to all the parties. Emery, any thoughts this week? Bit of fond adieu to Axanar.
Final thoughts on Axanar. I promise we won't talk about it anymore, listeners that are tired of this. But yes, we absolutely loved getting the opportunity to nerd out over some Star Trek fan films. I guess my only thoughts are that, you know, this didn't go to trial. It settled, which is probably the best for both parties, I would imagine. Axanar on their end is, you know, shortening their feature length film to two 15-minute shorts, and they're going to have to, I assume, abide by the rest of the guidelines that CBS has laid down. One of those guidelines is that they can't have any people that are taking part in the fan production have ever or will ever be parts of official Star Trek production. So I think that, as far as I understand, if I remember correctly, Axanar has a couple people on staff or actors and actresses that were part of the original Star Trek series. And so I wonder what the state of their involvement is, if that's changing. Other issues that might come up, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we see some article about, you know, Axanar backers being very upset about this turn of events and trying to find, you know, some kind of recovery there for them. But, you know, as we know, this was funded on Kickstarter, so that's not likely going to succeed. You know, my final thought is just that it is a little bit of a shame that CBS's, you know, says things like, you know, we support fan art. We recognize, you know, these kind of studios love to say that they support fan art when it is purely free advertising for them. They support fan art.
Right.
But, you know, the idea that these guys, you know, after going through all these lawsuits, after making their feature length film, after shortening it to 15 minutes and jumping through hoops, they're only going to be allowed to post it on YouTube, and they're not going to be allowed to get any advertising revenue from it. So it's you know, intellectually dishonest, again, to say that you support fan art, but you're not going to allow these people to actually produce it, because frankly, the arts require money, and advertising revenue is how fans can commercialize and can make possible the creation of this kind of fan art on this level. So, it's a mixed bag, but we're going to not have anything to talk about until the next fan art case comes up.
Yes, we'll keep our eyes open. And I think the moral of this story, or the takeaway I have, is that fair use is hard. It's always been hard. It continues to be hard. And I think it would have been really hard for Axanar here. And so in that sense, the settlement doesn't really surprise me at all. It's actually a good segue into our tip of the week, which is also that emphasizes how fair use is hard. And I guess the way I couched our tip was to have sanity. You know, there's that famous attributed to Einstein statement that when you do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result, that's the definition of insanity. Shepard Fairey dodged that recently in coming up with his posters that were released in connection with the Women's March that bear a lot of resemblance sort of thematically to his famous Hope poster. The resemblance that it doesn't bear is that he did not use an AP photo this time that someone else claimed the rights in and claimed misappropriation of. Instead, this time around, Shepard Fairey took these photographs of the people featured and then created his artwork from them. So there is no difficult fair use argument that he's going to have to make as to these posters that you may have seen a lot of over the last week in coverage of last Saturday's Women's March. So tip of the week, learn fair use is hard and learn that lesson. And if you have to change course to avoid fair use battles, I think that's a good thing to do. Even if it doesn't further the development of fair use law, it's probably better for Shepard Fairey in the long run that he doesn't have to make those kinds of battles. Also, our resource of the week. If you are someone who is interested in doing research, whether as a worker or as a company in the area of self-driving cars, we have a final act of the Obama administration where the U.S. Department of Transportation has designated 10 sites in 9 states to serve as the proving grounds for self-driving cars. So if you're interested in that research and testing, either in your corporate capacity or your personal one, you might want to get to one of these 10 sites, which are all delineated at The Verge. There are 2 in California, 1 in Michigan, various other locations around the country as laid out in Andrew Hawkins' article at The Verge. So hie thee to where you can do self-driving car testing pursuant to this final order from the U.S. Department of Transportation in the last administration. And to conclude our show, we have not one but 2 animal selfies of the week. We'll start with one that was sent in by my former co-host, the delightful Evan Brown, which is a very badass cat, for lack of a better word. A selfie with the crew that was posted to Reddit. There we go. So this cat isn't taking any guff from anybody and has the posse to back it up. And then the second animal selfie of the week, delightfully timed in the wake of the Slants argument, which we discussed last week. Emery was happy to discover, and I was happy to remember, that there is this outlet that apparently still to this day is taking the U.S. Supreme Court's audio from each of its oral arguments and acting it out with dogs. So let's hear a bit of the Slants argument as portrayed doggy style.
Based on that provision, the PTO denied respondents' application to register the Slants as a service mark for his band. The PTO's ruling did not limit respondents' ability to use the mark in commerce or otherwise to engage in expression or debate on any subject he wishes. Because Section 52A's disparagement provision places a reasonable limit on access to a government program rather than a restriction on speech, it does not violate the First Amendment.
Is copyright a copyright?
We even got some speech argument in there for you, David. I had forgotten all about Puppy Justice, but it's still going strong. So they're wonderful. I don't know if these qualify as animal selfies, but they are delightful. Emery, do you remember when this first got started or how it all got started?
I think it was the Colbert Report, right? Where maybe it was the, I don't know. Wait, no, it wasn't the Colbert Report. It was Last Week Tonight, maybe, with John. Yeah, too many, you know, infotainment, you know, comedians. But yeah, yes. John Oliver's show. Last Week Tonight, thank you, chat, had proposed this idea. And I think they released a whole bunch of stock footage and let anyone use it, you know, freely licensed, I guess. And this is the result. And I love it. Thank you, YouTube. Thank you, Internet, for creating this. This is magical.
Yes, and there is our animal selfie, animal copyright tie-in, because who knows if the dogs have actually licensed their names, images, or likenesses for use in this fashion, but we all get to enjoy them anyway. So I certainly find that a delightful part of the week. David, the most delightful part of my week thus far has been this sharing this time on this show with you. Thank you so much for joining us. It's just been amazing. Really helped us understand a lot about the important issues we've discussed today.
Well, thanks for having me on. It was fun.
Of course, I am sporting my EFF shirt.
I noticed that.
I am sporting my EFF bumper sticker. Of course, everyone, if you're not already a supporter of EFF, please do go to their donate page, buy their wonderful merch, and support their wonderful efforts, because the countless good things that EFF does for the rights of all of us who transact our lives online are invaluable. So thank you so much for your work with EFF, David. Anything else in particular that you want to plug that you're working on or that people should be aware of?
Oh, gosh. We're trying to publish a ton of stuff on EFF.org right now and trying to keep up with everything that's happening with the new administration. So I would just recommend that. I will shortly also be putting my EFF camera sticker back on the cover of my camera as well. So if you are more concerned with this administration than were with the last one about your security, take some action on that. So.
All right. Thanks so much again for joining us. Emery, so wonderful chatting with you again, too. You had to cut out early last week. I had a power failure last week. I'm glad that we've both made it down to bring this show in for a landing.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. It was a great show. I'm glad everything has gone off so far without a hitch.
Yes, not great.
Knock on wood, and I've got to run to bar prep shortly, so things are about to get much worse.
Yes, I'm perfectly happy to let you go now if you need to run, but I'm going to just let our listeners know that we record this show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific Time, 1900 UTC. If you go to twit.tv/live, you can watch along live with us. We hope that you'll do that if you can. It's always fun. We love it when folks jump into IRC at irc.twit.tv and play along with us during the show. Makes it a very fulfilling and fun experience for us all. But don't worry if you can't join us live. It's perfectly okay to go to twit.tv/twill and check out all of the different ways that you can enjoy the show. Audio only, video in various formats, all kinds of help for you there on how you can watch on your computer or your phone, listen while you're working out, listen while you're driving, whatever works best for you. We're just happy that you come back over and over again to make us part of your life, or even if you're just listening for the first time, this show, welcome, and we hope you will come back. We hope you'll email us and otherwise get in touch with us between the shows. Our Twitter handles have been down at the bottom the whole time, of course, for all the folks watching video. But if you're not watching video, I am D. Howell on Twitter. Emery is Emery Roan on Twitter. David is David Green on Twitter. If you'd like to reach out to any of us on that platform, the show also has a Facebook page, a Google Plus page, good opportunities for you to express yourself in longer than 140 characters if you're so inclined. Or you can always email us to Mike Keyes, who couldn't join us this week, is mike@twit.tv. Emery is emery@twit.tv. I'm Denise@twit.tv. Please do let us know your thoughts about the show, folks you'd like us to reach out to invite on, topics you'd like us to explore in more detail, your thoughts and reactions to what we've already discussed. Always great to hear from you in any of those places. And we will be back next week. Emery, are you still here with me or no? Did you head out?
I'm still here.
You're still here. You want to tease our guest for next week?
Okay, so next week, if all the cards fall into place, hopefully we will have Ben Wisner on from the ACLU, Ed Snowden's lawyer. So I am super stoked about that, and I hope you guys are too. If you have any questions, go ahead and send them to us via email or Twitter. And it's going to be a great show. I'm looking forward to it.
Looking forward to that one as well. We hope that you'll try and join us then or whenever you can catch This Week in Law. Until then, take care.